In the name and in the spirit of the divine truth that dwells within each of us, let us step out now from our silent complicity in evil. For we come today not to bring peace, but a sword that cuts through the lies around us and within us, and that separates us from a corrupt and a murderous world. A sword that dispels the darkness and raises us up to stand solely under the law of God. We come today as part of a called-out remnant of humanity to establish a just society in the shell of the old, by pulling down the old so that we may raise up the new, in the world and in ourselves. And welcome to the premier broadcast of Here We Stand, which is a weekly platform to awaken and arm our people. I'm your regular host, Kevin Annett. This is a continuation of Radio Free Canada, and as a matter of fact, all of the programs of Radio Free Canada are posted at our new site, bbsradio.com/herewestand. Well, Abraham Lincoln, in 1861, just on the verge of the American Civil War, said these words, "In times like the present, men should utter nothing for which they would not willingly be responsible through time and eternity." Well, there's a similar kind of civil war imposed on all of us now, wherever we are in the world, a choice of which power we will serve, a murderous corporatocracy or we the people gathered under the common law. What we utter on this program, we take personal responsibility for. That's been our theme for 3 years now. We're enacting our vision in the world, not only through the common law, but its courts. That's part of the theme of today as we kick off this new series. Our guest from Scotland is David Scott, who's one of the founders of the Scottish Common Law Court. Dave's going to be with us at about 20 minutes after the hour. I'm also joined by Rachel Aird, who is a journalist from London, Ontario. She's been on the show several times before to talk about satanic ritual crimes in London. And I thought it's especially relevant that Rachel join us today on this new show because of an item in the news we're going to talk about. And I'm very pleased to have her with me again. As a matter of fact, she's on the line. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Kevin.
It's great to have you back again after a little while. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I wanted to also tell folks that an important announcement. Our show is Here We Stand. Can be followed as well now on the Veterans Today Network. Now, this is a very important network. It's got millions of listeners every month, and you can find it at veteranstoday.com. Our shows will be posted there every week. Also, some of our books from Amazon.com, two of them, Fallen, the story of the Vancouver Four, and Unrelenting, the story of our campaign to expose genocide in Canada. Those can now be found on ebook, as well as the regular paperback publishing through Amazon.com. So, Rachel, let's hop in here. We've got a few minutes before Dave comes, but I wanted to get down and maybe talk a little bit about why we're doing what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know that coming in, you know, from a place like London, Ontario, where you've seen, you know, these crimes, we've talked about the child trafficking in that. There was an item in the news, and I wanted to share that with folks in case they haven't heard. It's involving a Vatican diplomat, actually. He was just, an all-Canada warrant has been put out for this guy. His name's Carlo Alberto Capella. He was a Monsignor, and he's 50 years old. He was caught with child porn on his computer. And now there's a Canada-wide warrant out for him. But unfortunately, as soon as the word got out on him, the Vatican recalled him to Rome immediately. This fellow was a Vatican diplomat in Washington, D.C., where he had diplomatic immunity. And once again, folks, he's scurried out of the country before the law can put their hands on him. Rachel, do you know anything about this guy or you know why this? The story came out of London, Ontario, and I'm just curious whether you know anything about that.
Well, Kevin, I can just say that when I was reading the article today, I just found I really wasn't surprised to hear that it was coming out of London, Ontario. From my research and my experience, London is just one of the most conservative cities in Canada. And with that, people have a tendency to, you know, turn the other eye when they see any suspicious behavior and they just really don't want to rock the boat or cause any issues. So it's especially true when it comes into a situation with anyone associated with the church or the diocese. Do you know anyone that would have been close to the priest or to this church that may have seen anything, would have just, you know, turned a blind eye and not investigated and let things slide for longer than it should have? So I'm just really not surprised at all to hear of this coming out of London, Ontario.
Well, you know, it's for me a very graphic example of why we need to start arming people with what they can do in their community. And that's kind of leading in a little bit about, people have questions about why we're doing a new radio program, why we call it Here We Stand. I'd like to discuss that for a few minutes, because people have written and actually asked us about that.
Sure, that sounds good.
Yeah, like it, with what I found with Radio Free Canada, which began in early 2015, we had a whole vision of how people could start this action in their community. But what we found all over the country, there were literally hundreds of people on board. But, you know, they were isolated in small towns. I did a count, and over 80% of the people on our network were not living in cities. They were living in small towns, you know, northern Alberta, the Yukon, rural Ontario. And it was very hard in a country as vast as Canada to pull all these folks together. And they were all saying the same thing. I don't know what to do in my community. You know, the people are so conservative. I don't know how to confront the church and these people who are doing the crimes. What do I do? So what we found is that a lot of people have fallen away, and yet what we have remaining, Rachel, is a core of people who want to get trained. They want to, they have the courage, and that's, you know, a really essential quality, that courage to come step out and to start doing things. So that's part of the rationale in the show. Here We Stand is taken from Martin Luther's comment when he nailed his theses to the door in 1517, 500 years ago, this October 31st, by the way. He said when he was, you know, the local archbishop demanded on pain of his own execution that he'd recant, Luther said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." And that to me is the attitude we're hearing from people all over, that, okay, we want to take action now, give us the means, teach us these things, we'll take action in our communities. I don't know if you're encountering that, you know, where you are, but I'm getting the sense all over, this kind of rising up now of people.
Right. Sure, yeah, I am seeing that actually here around me too. People are getting very passionate about the issues and looking to take action. So how would you say that this show is different than Radio Free Canada? And who are the Covenanters?
Well, like I say, the program here is aimed at kind of a different audience. It's not a general news program aimed at, you know, the people in general. We have a very targeted audience now. You could call them our cadre, if you like, the people who are the remnant, if you like, those who are willing to take action and who have the vision, but they need to start acting on it. And one of the things that we realize when we go from talk to action, our eyes have to be open all the more. We have to have our blindfolds off, because we're moving into dangerous water sometimes. And that's right. The idea behind the show. Now, it's sponsored by this group, the Covenanters, and I made contact with them, or rather they made contact with me about a year ago now. They're a group of people. They arose out of Scotland and Ireland, and there's some people in America as well. They're named after this group that emerged in the 1600s as part of the Reformation that said, okay, we are going to take back our church as a first step to taking back our community. These Covenanters said, we will not have kings or popes ruling over us. They brought in a declaration in 1643 that said the Scottish Church is self-governing. They got rid of the London archbishops, and they said, we're going to govern our own kirk or Presbyterian assembly. Now, all of that, it's really interesting when you trace that. A lot of the ideas that led to the American Republic came out of that same movement, and so these Covenanters are doing two things. They're operating on a fairly religious level, if you like. They're trying to call people out of all these false churches and saying it's time to reclaim, you know, the gospel of Christ and to act it and not be tied to these murderous corporations. They've been very involved in our work to expose these crimes of the Anglican and the Catholic Church and the United Church in Canada. But they're doing more than that, as they're also a secular movement saying we need to pull people out of the system. We've got to get them out of the cities. We've got to get our children into healthy rural environments. And they're trying to build that. So it's a very exciting movement, and it's got a real vision attached to it as well. It isn't just do-goodism. So that's part of where this show is coming from, and we're definitely linked to their activities.
I see. Thank you for explaining that in more detail.
Yep. So I think it's exciting because, you know, what one of the criticisms people have had as well, quite frankly, is that there's an old saying, you have to be 90% inspiration and 10% routine when you're trying to do anything new. Well, often we become the opposite. We talk about issues, talk about them ad infinitum, and we don't inspire people. We don't give them a sense that, yes, we have a vision, and we're capable of doing it and acting on it. So that's part of what we're going to be trying to do. Like with Dave Scott today, our guest, we're going to try to bring people on who are actually doing something in their communities and have a vision behind it.
Right, right. Well, you know, when you talk about people that have a vision and that are also taking action with that, I guess you must have some perspective, you know, over the past 3 years about some gains and some lessons that you've had with the Common Law movement. Like, could you speak a little bit about your campaign around that to stop child torture and child trafficking and that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, it's a big topic. It spans nations now. As a matter of fact, our movement over the last 15 to 20 years has helped spark a lot of the awareness now that you see, like when you see in the media 400 people named in Canada have been involved in child porn, that kind of thing. There's been an awakening about that because of our work to expose this trafficking. Plus, going along with it, it means for people to fight back. So the Common Law movement has really had a lot of fits and starts. It's setting up courts, as we'll hear about today, in places like Scotland, where people are fed up with the existing corrupt system, and they're establishing their own courts under the common law. And what we find now, and one of the reasons I wrote a number of the books that people can find on Amazon.com, is that people need to be trained now. And it's a big step to go from talking about something to saying, okay, we are actually going to convene a court in our community. We're going to issue warrants for people to show up. We're going to establish our own enforcement arm. And this is the tricky part, to say, okay, how are you going to enforce the verdicts? How are you going to bring people into court? We need our own body of sheriffs. That's one of the questions we'll ask Dave Scott today. Are they doing that? Are they relying on the existing police, who are often controlled politically, you know, by the elites involved in these crimes? Or do we need to create that ourselves? So that's some of the lessons. We're actually going to be talking about that over the upcoming shows, about how people are doing that on the ground.
I look forward to hearing what he has to say about that. So I wondered if you'd be able to kind of connect the dots for me a little bit when we talk about specifically like child trafficking and that issue, but then also there's the much broader concern about the ongoing genocide in Canada. So could you kind of connect the dots and just sort of discuss that campaign a little bit?
Yes, very much, because it's really another reason that we launched the show, because as folks may know, if you follow our work, itccs.org, there was a really important, a really historic report that came out on September 5th. And that went all over the world. It went to all the diplomats of the UN. It was read in the European Union and some of its committees. And you can read it if you go to the September 5th posting at itccs.org. It basically said, it documented in great detail the what they call the continuity of genocide that's going on in the world now. And they use the example of Canada, which we've documented so well, that many of the children who went missing in the residential schools, that happened at the hands of the very same people who are making the Aboriginal women go missing today. We've not only named some of the names, but also the forces involved, a lot of Chinese and American corporations that seem to be actually funding people to go in there and terrorize Native families off their land. And so, you know, this is a very important report because it's showing that our work is becoming international. And one of the things that are requested in the report is that other countries actually send peacekeepers to Canada to guard people like you and me, to guard the eyewitnesses so that more of these people don't disappear. I mean, we've had seven people in our network, say seven Native men and women, die of probable foul play because of their involvement in this movement. It gets very dangerous in a place like the West Coast, you know. And so we're asking for peacekeepers. We're asking the international community to come in and help us. And that is really beginning to send shockwaves, you know, through church and state in Canada. We know that for a fact. So we just have to keep up that pressure. and, you know, we're confident it'll achieve the same kind of result with God when we force Pope Benedict to resign.
Yes. Well, I honor your courage for the work that you're doing and for the people that you're speaking of that are on the ground and, you know, taking action with courage. And there's a lot, I'm sure there's a lot of appreciation for those peacekeepers that are coming in. It's amazing that we can think of this as a global initiative and not something that's confined to Canada.
Well, absolutely, Rachel. That, I think that's the main point, that one of the main points is that we're at the point now where we have to say to people, you don't have to cooperate in a murderous system anymore. You can pull out, you know, and we're trying to set up their alternative so that's possible. So that's part of the, you know, just one final thing, because I know Dave is waiting. We've got him on. He's about to come on, Dave Scott from Scotland. But I just wanted to say as an analogy, there was something that happened before the American Revolution that really planted a lot of the seeds for it. There was a thing in the in America called the Great Awakening. It happened in the 1740s and 50s, and it was a real kind of grassroots evangelical movement among the people that really gave people a sense that not only was God with them in their life, but they could act on what they read in the Gospels and what they felt in their own life. They could be self-governing communities, and the very people doing that, sure enough, really were in the spearhead of the struggle to establish a common law republic in America. So it's kind of like the inner awakening leads to that outer transformation in the world, as long as we're continuing to link the two and not seeing our own spirituality as something off there in a vacuum, but is very connected to how we live in the world. Politics and spirituality are really one and the same, and that's also going to be one of the themes of our show. So we want to unite those forces as well as the people.
Sounds interesting.
Enough said. I'm very happy to have David Scott with us. David, are you with us? Welcome, brother. It's good to have you with us.
It's very good to be here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rachel is with us as well. Now,
hello, Rachel.
David, I wanted to ask you to give a little bit of a background as to how you got involved in the Common Law Court, a little bit about yourself, and also what is the Common Law Court of Scotland?
Well, my involvement with the court was looking at one of its operations as it looked at a particular case where a person had taken out a commercial lien against corrupt officials who had caused them enormous loss via quite clear fraudulent behaviour. So he'd gone through this lien process and had a perfected lien, and they had offered essentially no defence, basically told him to get lost was the defence. There was no substantial defence offered. But the difficulty that he faced was, well, what does he do with this? How can he get it sort of endorsed through a court? And the court system in Scotland, for reasons that we'll maybe get to, wasn't open to this. So he brought this before a common law court. And a jury looked at it and concluded that the paperwork of the lien was properly done and it was all perfected, and the court certified it accordingly. Now, as far as sort of how I got there, I got involved in these types of matters by supporting a campaigner against child sexual abuse called Robert Green. He was locked up near my hometown. On extremely spurious grounds. He was held for 96 days on remand. And this is a pensioner with an impeccable record. Apart from campaigning against child sexual abuse, he's been entirely law-abiding and is an extremely lawful man. So he was locked up for 96 days before coming to trial. And I got involved in the campaign to get him bailed as his health was deteriorating. And that kind of started me looking at issues surrounding justice and injustice in Scotland. Before that, I'd been an engineer, still am an engineer, company director, and run a small engineering consultancy. So my background is not anything to do with the law, but it is to do with logic, which does help.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, David, how you got involved in this, because I met Robert Green. I spoke at a conference in Northampton, in 2010, and he was there part of the Holy Greed campaign. And, you know, the whole thing about child trafficking and that, but that we found all over the world, is the degree to which politicians, you know, establishment people, high up authorities are very much involved in these networks. And that's one of the things that explains why somebody like Robert goes to jail. Are you finding that in Scotland, that when these issues are being taken on, people get that kind of opposition and persecution? And is that one of the things that led to the formation of this court?
Yes, very much so. Just to give you a couple of examples, Holly Gregg named to the authorities 22 abusers. One was now deceased, was the head of forensic investigation in Aberdeen Police. And one was a senior judge, still serving, still very much serving in the Scottish judiciary. And this was part of the problem. But to give you another example, unrelated to Robert, I was interviewing a very courageous young lady who had been trafficked aged 14 out of the care system into the massage parlor, which is just a front for a brothel. So she was exploited and bullied and coerced and then abused in every way possible, but she managed to free herself. She managed to study the law. She started to fight back against the system that had let her down. And she's been researching how big this is. Now, a couple of years ago, this sort of earning was added into the official GDP figure for the United Kingdom. And in fact, we had to pay extra to the European Union because our GDP went up so much when we started to count things like drug dealing and prostitution. And the estimate for prostitution for female prostitution is over 5 billion, 5.3 billion a year, pound sterling. And if you add in male rent boy prostitution, it's up over 8 billion. It's a vast, vast industry. That's every year. So the amount of influence that can buy, before you get to the issue, there have been senior judges in Scotland who for years have been known to go to the massage parlors. Now, this not only opens them up to blackmail, but also introduces them into the sort of criminal fraternity. And this was known for years, and these people continued to sit on the bench, and nothing was done. So this is the sort of corruption that we face.
Rachel, just let me ask if you had any questions or comments before I've got more for Dave here.
Well, sure, actually. Dave, I appreciate that you gave a little background about how you became involved, but I was wondering if you could give a little bit of specifics about the formation of the Scottish Common Law Court as a whole.
Well, it's come out of essentially a reaction from people who cannot find justice and cannot find lawful remedy. The problems they're facing are several fold. One, there's corruption, right? There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes deals. There is undue influence by things like the Speculative Society and other sort of secret societies. And there is what, at least on the face of it, appears to be cover-up and corruption. The perception, at least, is that if you are taking a case to the Scottish courts, you will get a decision that fits the establishment view of what Scotland is. You'll not get justice, you'll get a decision that fits. So that's one problem.
I see.
The second one is deception, because so much of what happens in a court is based on deception. A little example of that would be if you go to be an observer, just a visitor sitting in the back of the court seeing what's going on. If there's 8 seats and 9 people turn up and there's a big wide corridor, you're not allowed to stand in the corridor. You're made to stand outside the court. You must have a seat. And the reason you must have a seat is you must go through the rigmarole of standing up when the judge comes in and sitting down when he tells you, because that gives him his authority. That
right.
defines the court, right? So there's consent happening there. But no one says there's consent happening there. So it's all done by deception. And the third big issue is the cost. The cost of going to law is now so much that if you're outside a small claims court, which is just about doable, if you have a dispute for anything less than £100,000, forget it. Right? It's too expensive.
Right.
If you have anything that's really complicated, the costs just spiral. And the effect of this is that justice becomes initially the realm of the rich and government. And as it goes on and it gets worse and worse, it becomes the realm of the super rich and government. Mm-hmm. Because it's only with access to taxation money that costs no longer are an issue. A couple of quick examples of that. One from the Robert Greene case. Robert was sued by Dame Louise Angelini, former Lord Advocate of Scotland, the highest law officer in Scotland who runs all criminal prosecution in Scotland. She was the fiscal in Aberdeen when most of the Holly Gregg case came to light. And Robert considered that she had not done her job properly in either post and made that plain. So she sued for defamation. What Robert didn't know when that suit was going on, and he was refused legal aid. So here he was in a foreign legal jurisdiction with no legal support at all, up against the Lord Advocate and the big row of barristers. He lost, not surprisingly. Now, there's no equality of arms. Now, what he didn't know is that in this private civil claim for defamation, Dame Elise Angelini had all of her fees paid by the Scottish government. And it took us years to find that out. And when we found it out and we started asking questions about it, we found there was a clause in the standard conditions of contract for every government official which says that if a government official is embroiled in a civil legal dispute which is in any way to do with their job, or if a former government employee is embroiled in a civil legal dispute which is in any way to do with their job, then the Scottish government, if it is in the interests of the Scottish government, can take on the costs of that. Not if it's in the interest of the people or justice or anything else. If it's in the interest of the Scottish government, they take on the cost and they prosecute the case. So you're faced with an enormous uphill struggle. Another example that we've found is that large organisations such as Scottish Water, which is a creature of statute, a company formed by statute under nominal private, under nominal government ownership, but operating as an independent company, which has enormous reserves. It has huge financial reserves. And it supplies all of the public water all over Scotland. So it sets the rates and gets money from everyone who uses water. If they are embroiled in any dispute with a private individual, they will rapidly take that, as rapidly as possible, they will take that to court. They will rack up as much as they can in expenses, very expensive lawyers, very expensive legal opinions. So if the person goes to court, Scottish Water don't really care because they can afford to lose. The private individual is betting his entire net worth on whatever the dispute is. It makes it a very unfair fight.
Yes.
David, one thing I wanted to ask was, you know, a lot of this, when you're describing the problems, I don't know the way judges are in Scotland, but in Canada, a judge can rewrite a court record. He can dismiss a case arbitrarily. He can deny due process to somebody. It's completely draconian power. And in common law, the jury is the center of power in a court, not the judge, not the magistrate. So to you, does it come down to the issue of the judges themselves, not simply the people who are judges, but the system itself of judge-run courts? Is that part of the problem, do you think?
Yes, very much so. The independence of the Scottish judiciary is held up as a great bulwark against wrongdoing. But of course, it depends on the judge. Now, there's been one book that I found written about the Scottish judiciary. It's very good and very interesting. But it's called Show Me the Judge and I'll Show You the Law. Because that's what the system is. You don't know the law until you're seeing who's making the decision.
Right.
They have a lot of power. One of the cases that this book details is in Scotland, all prosecution is via the Crown Office, is via this one state prosecutor controlled by the Lord Advocate. In England, it's different. And a lot of English organisations or British organisations don't realise the difference. So you had the taxman, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, came up to Scotland to prosecute a case. And they went in to see the judge and say, we're HMRC, we'll be prosecuting this case. And the judge says, no, you won't. He said, yes, we will, we're HMRC. He said, no, you're HMRC in Scotland, you have no prosecutorial powers. So the taxman said, what's your name? Who's your boss? And the judge says, I'm a Scottish judge, I don't have a boss. And he was right. He could make the decision. So there's a very high degree of independence. Now, that degree of independence can be used one of two ways. It can be used for good or it can be used for ill. Now, the problem is, too often, it's not been used to defend the individual people. Sometimes it is. There's some great examples in the Scottish judiciary of people standing up for the little man. But equally, there's a lot of unseen influence behind the scenes. And that degree of independence without scrutiny, and it's the lack of scrutiny that's the real problem, and the lack of openness is the real problem.
Well, that's the question. How do you get scrutiny? We find this time again in trying to take cases like, for example, about the crimes in Indian schools or any of these things about child torture. How do you get accountability in a system where the judges themselves are linked to the government and the Crown, who are the guilty parties in these cases? You know, I mean, so obviously there needs to be an alternative system of law that gets around that. And that's why I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about, is the common law court in Scotland, is it an actual rival court to the existing ones, or does it work within the existing courts?
It's completely separate and it's based on common law. It's not, it would be presumptuous yet to call it a rival, but that's the intention. It seeks to be a neutral court. It's not a campaigning body or anything like that. It doesn't have any axe to grind for itself. It's an alternative that people may choose to use responsibly to find a way to get justice and proper lawful remedy without going through the statute system and the statute courts, but rather to go to the people, to their peers, to a jury of their peers, and find justice that way. So right. It's looking to provide an alternative route, and this is the key, because in so many things in life, what makes the free market system, for example, better than communism and socialism, is not that people who run free market organizations are better people, but the choice that the consumer has forces them to be better, because they have to please the customer. If in Scotland, everything goes through the Crown Office, right? If the situation was there was a choice and the police came to you and said, we've found the person who burgled your house and we have the following three prosecutors for you to choose from, who would you like to prosecute your case? If that degree of choice existed, then the problems with the Crown Office would vanish. It's the state-imposed monopoly, which means that they can get in, they can make decisions, and they are untouchable.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the choice is vanishing, whether it's in the economy with the kind of domination of cartels and conglomerates over the little guy, or within law and politics. We find that corporatization of everything, you know, and so there's this constant struggle to defend people. So much of our energy is involved in just keeping our head above water, keeping other people's heads above water, and that's why holding out something like this court is so essential. Rachel, any remarks or questions?
Sure. There was actually something I wanted to ask, David. I was just wondering how would the common law courts plan to enforce the verdicts? You know, would they have their own police force, or are they working with the existing police force, or what would that look like?
Well, that's going to emerge over time, I think. What we've had so far, we've had several cases through, and the court is also doing simple things like registering property and registering births, so you can have a common law registration of a birth rather than, or in addition to, a statutory birth certificate. And that gets away from some of the straw man legal person problems as well.
Yep.
They've had some success with using commercial liens and actions placed on property sales to stop property sales going through if there's a dispute that's not been resolved. So there has been some forward progress on that, but it's going to have to be built up by use and by demonstrating a way forward, because it's got to come from the ground up. It's got to be people led. It's got to be a grassroots movement, and it has to be people standing up and acting lawfully and finding remedy, you know, through this process. Hopefully people will start to choose to resolve disputes through it. You'll resolve civil legal disputes, because for one thing, it will be a fraction of the cost of the existing system.
Right.
And then when you get to cases where people don't want to agree to use the court and agree to have the court settle a dispute, suppose you're trying to recover a debt, I think that has to be, that still has to be fully worked out. I can only suggest that let's talk in maybe a few months' time, or you might talk to someone else involved in a few months' time. There might be some progress to report by then on enforcement. It's one of the hardest things, of course.
Yeah, of course, definitely. We are going to, before you go off the air today, Dave, I want you to mention there is kind of a whole campaign over the next few years you guys have in mind. But I wanted to ask about that whole thing of registering births and that, because it's a real... Are you saying that when you register your information with the common law court, you can get around that whole fake system the government has of issuing a capital letter ID, calling you a corporation, and then acting in your name? Is that a way around it? Is that the idea behind it?
Well exactly so. The people are registering the births of their children, so you have a record of live birth. And it's through a common law court, so it's within the common law. It doesn't relate to any statute law whatsoever. So it's completely clear of the trickery of the official system. And that's been quite popular. The courts had quite a lot of people registering births, including they've had to create an international wing to it, because they had some registrations from Australia come in. So it's obviously something that's of interest, certainly
right,
across the common law jurisdictions across the globe.
Well, it definitely gives people a sense that they can do something, that they're not beholden onto some faceless bureaucracy, but they can do something in their community to take back their power. And that's very much part of the vision behind the common law movement.
This is exactly right, that it's people doing it for themselves. So what the Scottish Common Law Court is providing is some information and guidance and showing the way a little bit, but it's asking people to organise themselves and set up a court and under this system and seek justice for themselves through this process. It's open source, it's for everyone, it's people-led. And it's inclusive. It's not a rival organisation coming in. It's an ability for people to seek justice for themselves and to seek lawful remedy, and to avoid the official system. To say to the official system, you know, thank you very much. You can stay over there. I don't want to come and be part of your court because it doesn't suit my interests, and I've got another option.
Excellent. Yeah, well, do you find you have to do a lot of community education about this? Is that part of your whole vision?
It's early days. I'm sure there's going to be enormous amounts of an enormous amount of questioning going on and education, yes, because you appreciate this. Like, to run a common law court, you need a jury, but you also need four court officers. And they've got to be of a certain standing, have a certain knowledge. So yes, there's going to be a lot of, if this starts to really build, and the early signs are very promising, there's going to be a lot of demand for people to educate themselves and to be able to contribute to this movement.
Right.
And it is that. It's a grassroots movement.
Before I forget, please tell us the website of the Scottish Common Law Court.
It is... It's www.scottishcommonlawcourt.com.
All right. And is there a way... Well, is there a contact info on that site if people want to get a hold of you?
It's not me, but they'll get the people who run the site. There's a contact page, and the people who run the site will respond. Yes, absolutely. Yes, there's an email. Email is info@scottishcommonlawcourt.com.
Great.
And yes, anything that goes through there will get a rapid response.
Now, tell us about the campaign over the next few years. What we were talking about the other day, just kind of what your perspective is on.
Well, this is something we've got a major launch coming forward. So some of it we're trying to keep somewhat under wraps until then. The major launch is on the 26th of October. Now, this is a separate organization. I'm very much part of this. It's called the Fresh Start Foundation, and it's an investigation, a people's investigation into child sexual abuse in Scotland. Now, what prompted this, or the last straw? There was a lot of unhappiness, and people like Robert Green have been campaigning for many years. Many people in Scotland have been supporting him to get a proper investigation into the Holly Gregg case and into some other cases. But the information had been mounting and the pressure had been mounting, and eventually the government said it was going to hold an official inquiry. Now, what happened initially was nothing. It was very, very slow. There was a long delay. And then the terms of reference were extremely narrow, so it was only children who had been abused in institutional residential care. So if you went to a school during the daytime and you were abused, that didn't count.
Right.
If you were abused by a senior politician who tied you up and put you in the trunk of his car and took you home, that didn't count. Only residential care was included. Now, even that was quite a lot of institutions around Scotland. So they appointed a panel of three people led by a QC to investigate. There's a QC called Susan O'Brien. There was two other people leading this panel. One was a professor from Cambridge with a lot of relevant experience. And the panel, you know, looked, the sort of qualifications they had looked appropriate. And then we started to get wind that all wasn't well. And then the Professor Lamb from Cambridge resigned. And when he resigned, he cited Scottish government interference. And then the chair, Susan O'Brien QC, resigned. And she resigned detailing the Scottish government interference. And what had happened was she'd been accused of essentially a throwaway line. And this throwaway line was held to be evidence that she wasn't considering the victims enough and wasn't a fit person. And it was a very strange situation where someone who just happened to be a Scottish National Party member, heard this statement, this sentence, and then several months later reported it to the Scottish government. And within a week, the Scottish government asked the chair of the inquiry for a resignation. And when you look at the statement, it was something about nothing. It looked like a fit-up. And what we were hearing is this was in response to certain well-connected interests applying pressure to this inquiry through the Scottish government.
Fresh Start Foundation is in response to all of this. Tell us about your campaign over the next few years.
Yeah, so all of that led to a breakdown in confidence in the government inquiry.
Right.
So what we've done is we've founded a citizens inquiry into this, and we are announcing the sort of detail of that on the 26th of October in a meeting in Edinburgh, and I'd love to come back on after that and give you all of the detail. But essentially what we're going to do is we're going to spend a couple of years, we're going to reach out to all of the victims and survivors all around Scotland, we're going to gather the information, and we're going to we're going to report to the people of Scotland as to what has been going on. And it's going to be done entirely without government support. We won't take a penny from the government. The people who are doing it are all working for free. And we are determined that we are going to deliver the truth to the victims and survivors and to the people of Scotland so that they can understand what has actually been going on.
Well, so this is an invitation, Dave, for you to come on our show on October 29th. And you can update us at that time. If not before then, we'll try to...
That would be perfect. I can give you all the details then once we've made the formal announcement. I can take you through just how we're approaching this task. It's going to be a work of several years, and there's a lot of people becoming involved, and we're very determined.
It's excellent, and it's, you know, as people learn these things, there's always spillover into other countries, and this is a mutually fertilizing process, as they say. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left for you, Dave, but we'll definitely have you back again soon. Is there anything, first of all, Rachel, do you have any other comments or things you want to kick in?
No, I've no other questions. I just enjoyed listening to what you had to say, David, and find it very exciting. So looking forward to hearing more later in October.
And so, Dave, is there anything you want to say to people in summary? Well, we still have you.
Just one little point is worth bringing out. It's often said in Scotland that the common law doesn't apply. We hear this from Scottish sheriffs, Scottish judges. Now, there was back in 2015, there was an evidence session in the House of Lords where the president of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom said in evidence to the law lords, which are your senior judges who sit in the House of Lords, he said, this is Lord Newberger of Abbotsbury, he said, in Scotland, they do not have the common law. Right? And at the end of this session, one of the Scottish law lords interrupted and he said, could I make a small addendum for clarification? In Scotland, we do not have the common law in the sense of the English common law. We have our own common law, which is the result of a whole number of influences over many centuries. And it just emphasises the point that we have a common law tradition in Scotland, and the judiciary and the courts in Scotland will deny this. They will look you in the eye and say it doesn't exist, and they're wrong. And that degree of either ignorance or deception has to be fought.
Well, also self-interest. The judges feel that their job's on the line if the people take over the courts. Definitely. Yes.
Indeed, and the entire Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service is, of course, a private company, and it's registered in New York, would you believe?
Really? That's interesting. Oh, final question, though, Dave. In the work you're doing, like this happens all over in our network, but in the work that any of you have been doing, have you faced opposition, harassment by the police, black ops, smear campaigns, anything like that?
Well, it's not been anything like you faced. There's been a little bit of hassle. One of the first people to put a case through the common law court when he got the decision went to sheriff's officers, like bailiffs, that would be the equivalent perhaps where you are, to get this decision enforced. And they passed the paperwork to the police saying it was a forgery. So the police then came knocking at his door. But when he assured them it wasn't a forgery and it was a properly convened common law court, the police went away, and so far they've not really been back. We'll see if anything comes of that. I think there will be opposition. This is so important. There has to be. If we do it right, there must be.
Yeah, there will be opposition, and we have to defend ourselves and the people around us. I ask that because I've asked Robert Green to come on our program very soon, and he can talk about what he's faced, that kind of harassment. And it's funny because earlier today I was on Andy Peacher's show with the Fresh Start Foundation, and on three occasions during the show we were cut off. The whole show was just shut down. So I think, you know, we can expect this, and people have to be aware of that.
Yeah, Robert Green's a good example, because Robert Green has suffered wrongful arrest. He was arrested, first time he was arrested for breach of a court order, termed in Scotland an interdict. Problem was that court order had never been served. They tried to serve it in Warrington after he'd left for Aberdeen, which is halfway across the country. So it hadn't been served, but he was arrested anyway. And that's completely fraudulent. When he was arrested the second time, when he went into jail and I visited him, all the way up from England, he was questioned about a completely different matter from the one that they had claimed to have arrested him on. And this was right. a matter of something called the Violate Club, which is a fetish club in Scotland run by an Airdrie lawyer. And in this, they do strange sexual acts to, amongst other things, dolls of children.
Oh, my
and,
God.
They have, in this club, they have many senior people of note, including some sheriffs and wives of sheriffs and school teachers and various other senior police officers and what have you. And Robert had been writing about it.
Well, time to make some citizen arrests on these bastards.
all they wanted to know was about the Violate Club. Now, right. we concluded, based on that, we concluded that the authorities thought that Robert was going to release the membership list.
Right, okay. We want to talk more about that.
That wasn't the case, but their action against him didn't seem to have any hugely round logic. And why arrest someone on one charge and then only want to question him about something completely unrelated? It was very strange.
Yeah, well, they've got him targeted, obviously. Dave, I can't thank you enough for coming on. We're going to have you on again real soon. And again, could you give the website for folks once more?
Certainly. The website, this is the Common Law Courts in Great Britain is the heading, and the website is www.scottishcommonlawcourt.com.
Thank you, brother. We'll talk to you again real soon. Thank you for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Bye for now. David Scott from my homeland in Scotland. Rachel, I thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be doing more of these, and it's good to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
And finally, to announce to folks, please come back again next week where we're going to be carrying this on. You can follow our work at bbsradio.com/herewestand, and also to flag one of our books, Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, a common law training manual. You can get that at amazon.com. Just put in my name, Kevin Annett, and it'll pop up. So until next week, let me just check if I've got any more announcements here. I had them, but they're gone. Oh, well. We'll be back in 1 week, and follow our work at itccs.org, murderbydecree.com, and if you want to get a hold of the Covenanters, the movement we described earlier, their email is congregationalcovenant, that's congregationalcovenant@gmail.com. If you want to write to yours truly, I'm at thecommonland@gmail.com, thecommonland@gmail.com. I thank you, brothers and sisters, for being with us again. I hope you're inspired to not only listen next week, but to carry it on. Contact us in order to know how to enact this in your community. And until next week, stay strong and stay clear. We thank you.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to Diggers' Sow.